Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso. Today we open our show with some breaking news from Santee, where a plane crash has killed at least two people and injured others, and we'll have details. Next, we'll have a report on Christian Youth Theater workers arrested for alleged sexual abuse of students in El Cajon. On our local government report, hear about hot agenda items coming up before city councils this week in La Mesa, El Cajon, and Santee. Then we'll have highlights from last weekend's Women's March in San Diego, plus reports on help for Afghan refugees in our region approved by county supervisors. Supervisors also voted to oppose all future placements of sexually violent predators locally until the state reforms the placement process. From California News Service, hear about federal student loan forgiveness for some government workers. And then on Tribal Beat, learn about a new mural in Ramona celebrating our region's Kumeyaay Native American heritage. From Public News Service, we'll have some national news headlines, including Declaration of Indigenous Peoples Day and more. Rose Schindler, a Holocaust survivor, will be the keynote speaker at the East County Chamber of Commerce's Women in Leadership Luncheon, and we'll have details. Then, hear how some controversial new state housing laws will affect communities across our region. And finally, on the second half of our East County Magazine show today, we'll share some East County ghost stories to get you in the spirit of the season with Halloween drawing near. So stay tuned for today's edition of the East County Magazine radio show, where East County matters. This is Miriam Raftery with a breaking news bulletin. A plane has crashed near Santana High School Monday afternoon at the intersection of Greencastle and Jeremy, setting homes nearby on fire. There are at least two reported fatalities, and at least two other victims have been transported to local hospitals. Santana High tweeted that all students are safe and a secure campus order has been lifted. Students were allowed to leave if they had no afternoon classes. The San Diego Sheriff has asked that the public avoid the area, and a hazmat team has been dispatched. It is unclear what caused the crash, though a high wind advisory is in effect for the area. The crash site is under the flight path for Gillespie Field, in an area where several past serious crashes have occurred.
Two former employees of Christian Youth Theater have been charged with felony sexual assault against students at CYT's El Cajon facility. San Diego County District Attorney Summer Steffen announced that David Hott has been charged with two felony counts for allegedly committing lewd and lascivious acts on a 13-year-old child in 2007. Brad Christian Davis is charged with felony sexual penetration by a foreign object involving a 16-year-old in 2010. If convicted, Hott could face up to 10 years in prison, while Davis could be sentenced to up to 3 years. San Diego Police Chief David Nislight thanked victims for their courage in coming forward, adding, "We must hold these individuals responsible for their actions so they don't have the opportunity to harm more children in the future." Because child victims of sexual abuse often wait years before reporting or speaking out, a longer statute of limitations applies than for some other crimes. Protecting children from sexual predators and making sure they are not re-victimized during the criminal justice process is my top priority, Steffen stated. The DA's office has reportedly been investigating at least 10 complaints involving CYT locally. Both the DA and San Diego police are asking any other victims to come forward and contact the police department. After serious allegations of sexual abuse surfaced last summer, including some against staffers not yet charged, CYT abruptly suspended its San Diego programs last July. However, local operations have since resumed. The CYT San Diego website now lists an upcoming production of Rapunzel in late October. CYT has its roots in El Cajon, where it formerly ran the city-owned East County Performing Arts Center for many years and has since gone national with its program for young people. Members of the Russell family, which founded CYT in 1981, would no longer serve in leadership roles, Artistic Director Robin Rebel-Smith announced in July 2020. However, Janie Cox, whose maiden name was Russell, is currently listed as Director of the Rapunzel production, indicating CYT misled the public and press in its earlier announcement. Jessica Pride, an attorney representing victims, has accused CYT of covering up crimes. She told NBC7, CYT knew of the abuse for years, and they created an environment that not only fostered it, but allowed for it to happen and then brushed it under the rug. A victim who contacted East County Magazine points out that one of the alleged victims is a son of CYT's founders and the sister of Janie Russell Cox, who has posted about his experience on Facebook. We emailed CYT to ask for comments on the charges and to ask what steps are being taken to protect children in its programs. CYT sent a response strongly condemning the alleged actions by the accused individuals, adding, "The alleged actions of the accused unquestionably contradict our values and our mission." The organization further states, "We have a thorough background check process for all our teachers, staff, and volunteers, as well as ongoing training requirements in child safety. These resources underscore our commitment to the safety of our children. We will continue to fully cooperate with authorities during their investigation." The organization declined any further comment.
This is Miriam Raftery with a local government report. East County's city councils have several major issues on their agendas this week. On Tuesday, La Mesa's city council will weigh whether to lease out public land on the former police station site for multi-use development, including apartments. La Mesa council members will also consider establishing an arts and cultural commission. In El Cajon, Tuesday's City Council meeting includes a proposal by staff for the city to oppose the county's proposed micro-enterprise home kitchen operations, a plan that would allow residents to prepare, sell, and serve limited numbers of meals from homes. Supervisors contend the ordinance would create opportunities for small entrepreneurs, including immigrants and people of color. But city staff in El Cajon raised concerns over potential impacts on neighbors, such as parking and traffic, as well as disposal of cooking fats, and creating an unfair business advantage over businesses that obtained permits and invested to operate in commercially zoned areas. And out in Santee on Wednesday, the smoking hot issue will be whether or not to approve legalizing marijuana-related businesses. You can find details on these items and other East County political news in the politics section at eastcountymagazine.org.
An estimated 10,000 people participated in the Women's March in San Diego on Saturday, October 3rd, joining similar events in nearly 500 cities across the nation. This year, organizers titled the event March for Reproductive Rights, amid concerns over the erosion of access to legal abortions in some states and fears that conservatives on the Supreme Court could overturn Roe v. Wade. Supporters of reproductive rights have been spurred to action by a new Texas law which the Supreme Court refused to block. It bans abortions as early as 6 weeks whenever a fetal heartbeat is present and allows any private citizen to file a lawsuit against anyone who helps a woman end her pregnancy, such as a doctor, friend, or relative. This week, a federal judge temporarily halted implementation of the Texas law as unconstitutional, but the decision, now on appeal, could be short-lived. In the past 10 years, over 500 state laws restricting abortion have been passed. Today, nearly 90% of U.S. counties don't have a single abortion provider, and five states have just one abortion clinic left, according to Act for Women. Several speakers addressed marchers gathered at Waterfront Park in San Diego. Manzanita Tribal Chairwoman Angela Elliott Santos from East County spoke of how Native Americans revere women and voiced concern over the erosion of rights for all women. State Senator Tony Atkins from San Diego described meeting the family of Becky Bell, a young woman who died after getting an illegal abortion. Senator Atkins asked,
"How many other young women have to find refuge elsewhere to get their health care? This is a civil rights for us. This is a civil rights for women. I knew that when I was 13.
Senator Atkins assured that she and other California leaders, including Governor Gavin Newsom and Assembly Speaker Anthony Rendon, stand with Planned Parenthood and are committed to protecting and strengthening reproductive rights in our state.
Look, I'll tell you, if we have to fight, by God, I'm glad to be in this fight with you. Yeah. California is a beacon.
Then, Senator Atkins rallied the crowd one last time.
And to the Supreme Court, I say, you will hear us. You will hear us.
The marchers also included three generations of women from an East County family. 13-year-old Alice said she's concerned about poor women who can't get abortions. She said, "People have been fighting for women's rights for years, and we're now in 2021, and we're still doing it." Alice adds, "A lot of my friends are worried that they won't be seen or heard, or have their rights." Seeking to provide federal protections for women and medical providers in all 50 states, even if Roe v. Wade is overturned, the House of Representatives last week passed the Women's Health Protection Act of 2021 by a 218-211 vote. The Senate is expected to take up the measure in a few weeks, after first addressing budget and infrastructure measures, but the vote is expected to be closely divided in the Senate. The bill would create a federal right in all 50 states for healthcare professionals to provide abortions under the rules established by the Roe v. Wade Supreme Court decision in 1973. That ruling guaranteed a right to abortion before viability, which occurs around 22 to 24 weeks. If the congressional bill passes the Senate, women's rights to a later-term abortion would also be federally protected if her life or health is in danger. President Joe Biden has said he will sign the bill into law if it reaches his desk. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Elijah McKee.
San Diego supervisors have voted unanimously to adopt a proposal by East County Supervisor Joel Anderson to have the county's Office of Immigrant and Refugee Affairs work with refugee resettlement agencies to help Afghan refugees who are arriving in our region. The board also approved Anderson's plan to ask the federal government to spend part of $9.5 billion in frozen Taliban assets to pay for refugee resettlements. In addition, supervisors approved a proposal by Supervisor Tara Lawson Reamer to create an Afghan resettlement task force. Anderson stated, "I am thankful that my colleagues recognize the importance of this measure that will ensure San Diego County is ready to welcome these refugees into our communities." He added that his East County district has a large population of Afghans and others with Middle Eastern heritage. In an earlier interview with 10 News, Anderson said parts of his district, including El Cajon and Spring Valley, have had 38,000 refugees from the Middle East settle there in recent years, including refugees from Iraq, Syria, Afghanistan, and other places. Anderson has said he views it as a moral obligation to assist them, but he also indicated he wants to avoid having local taxpayers fund the resettlements, if possible, by having the federal government spend those frozen Taliban assets. He notes that in the past, the U.S. has used frozen assets of Cuba and Iran to resettle refugees from those regions. An estimated 58,000 Afghan refugees are expected to arrive in the U.S. following the U.S. troop withdrawal that ended a 20-year war in Afghanistan, a war that started after the 9/11 terrorist attacks. With the Taliban takeover, those who helped American troops or aided U.S. contractors face risk of death if they remain. So do women's rights and human rights advocates. Many refugees fled Afghanistan, along with their families, with few personal possessions. And now California is expected to take in about 5,200 of those refugees, more than any other state. Around 1,300 Afghan refugees are expected to arrive in San Diego County by December, says Jill Galante, co-leader of Helping El Cajon Refugees, 10 News reports. Her organization has solicited donations of household goods from East County community members to help the new arrivals set up households as they arrive, and some have already arrived. These families have been provided temporary aid by groups like Jewish Family Services, Catholic Charities Diocese, Refugee and Immigrant Services, and Helping El Cajon Refugees. These groups provide short-term housing and food, as well as help with jobs, enrolling students in schools, translation, English classes, and short-term counseling for refugees who have experienced trauma. But aid agencies provide only short-term assistance for about 90 days. There is a critical need for long-term help, particularly to find permanent housing for refugee families in San Diego County, an area with very high housing costs and a shortage of affordable homes. Board Chairman Nathan Fletcher sided with Anderson after some residents testified against helping the refugees, citing safety concerns. Fletcher noted that all Afghan refugees have been vetted by U.S. intelligence and law enforcement agencies, as well as customs officials, before they're admitted to the U.S. "They love this country," said Fletcher, a Marine Corps combat veteran, and he added, "If we're a country that can't keep our word to people who sacrificed for us, then shame on us." The Afghan Resettlement Task Force, proposed by Supervisor Lawson Reamer, aims to pull together resources from nonprofits, local governments, and school districts, serving as a central clearinghouse. Nadine Topozada, the director of Refugee and Immigrant Services in the San Diego region, says the ability to rely on a task force to provide support after short-term aid runs out is crucial. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Miriam Raftery.
This is East County Magazine's Crime Beat. On the streets, reporting on crimes impacting communities across our region, helping to keep you safe and informed.
By a unanimous vote, San Diego County supervisors adopted a proposal by Supervisor Jim Desmond to oppose all future placements of sexually violent predators in the county until state law is changed to allow participation by local governments, including veto power for communities. Supervisor Desmond says for too long, San Diego County communities have been living in fear knowing a sexually violent predator could be placed in their neighborhood. He adds, "I would not vote to put a sexually violent predator next door to my family, and I will not vote to put a sexually violent predator next door to your family." It's unclear, however, whether the state will honor the supervisor's actions, since placement power ultimately does rest with the Department of State Hospitals. During the hearing on October 5th, where 22 people spoke in favor of the proposal, Supervisor Joel Anderson stated, "What people don't understand is we have no legal power. San Diego currently has 5 sexually violent predators placed in local communities, including some in Anderson's East County District, and more proposed." Anderson noted that the state often places predators in poor, low-income neighborhoods where people have the least ability to fight and push back. Recent placements have included low-income communities in Campo and Hakumba. But recently, some neighborhoods have mobilized to block placement of sexually violent predators in places with children and others at risk. Kathleen Hedberg, the former president of Grossmont Mount Helix Improvement Association, helped lead successful efforts that resulted in a judge withdrawing a home near Mount Helix proposed for placement of 2 sexual predators, Merle Wakefield and Douglas Badger. Badger's 5 convictions included kidnapping, violent sexual assaults, and molestation of young children. He had been diagnosed as a sexual sadist who enjoyed hurting others. Badger was later proposed for placement in Rancho Bernardo, where an outcry from residents led the property owner to withdraw his property from consideration. The homeowner is also seeking to break his agreement with Liberty Healthcare, the company the state contracts with to place sexual predators, for any future proposed predator releases. Among the most compelling testimony presented to supervisors was that of Mary Taylor, who was sexually assaulted over 30 years ago by Alvin Quarles. Dubbed the bolder-than-most rapist by authorities, Quarles was proposed for release locally, but his conditional release from a state hospital, which had been approved by a court, was later overturned by an appellate court judge. Taylor told supervisors, "There is no excuse for letting a known sexually violent predator rejoin a family community." And she concluded, "Surely the rights of the innocent must supersede the rights of sexually violent predators." Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso in the heart of San Diego's East County.
Hundreds of thousands of teachers, nurses, social workers, military officers, and others in public service can breathe a sigh of relief tonight as the Biden administration has just announced major reforms to the Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program. Education Secretary Miguel Cardona says the program will be streamlined so about 550,000 more people will qualify.
In 2007, Congress made a pledge to forgive loans if you serve the community for 10 years, and we're going to make that right.
The program is supposed to pay off remaining loans for people who have made payments for 10 years while working in a qualifying profession. But you had to have a certain type of loan. Now people can get a waiver and be able to count payments on other types of student loans toward the forgiveness program. Mary Wolf is a math teacher in Tulsa who was told after a decade of payments that she'd have to convert to a different type of loan and start the clock all over again.
The student loan process has been a nightmare, to say the least. I was led to believe a whole 10 years that I was headed towards public service loan forgiveness.
According to the Institute for College Access and Success, from 2018 to 19, 48% of California college graduates had student loan debt, with an average debt load of more than $21,000. Jesse Yednak Gray is an epidemiologist with the Brown University School of Public Health. She says the changes are a light at the end of the tunnel after years of crushing debt.
It's a lot of money that you don't get to use to save for retirement or save for, say, my son's education either. It's ending up costing so much more than I ever thought it would.
The changes mean more military officers will qualify, and the feds are going to review all applications that were previously denied. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter. Find our 8 trust indicators for transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
Courage is the theme of the 19th Annual Women in Leadership Luncheon hosted by the East County Chamber of Commerce on October 22nd at Viejas Casino and Resort. The keynote speaker will be Holocaust survivor Rose Schindler, who survived the Auschwitz concentration camp where she was sent with her family when she was just 14 years old, and many of them did not survive. She is involved in the Butterfly Project, which has a mission to educate students about the Holocaust, and she is president of the New Life Club, a San Diego Association of Holocaust Survivors, most now in their 90s. She has previously been awarded many honors for her work and continues to speak at local schools and events across our region. Tickets to the Women in Leadership Luncheon, which also includes awards presented to other women leaders locally, are available at the East County Chamber's website. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
This is East County Magazine's Tribal Beat, bringing you news for and about our region's Native American communities.
A dedication ceremony was held on October 2nd for Ramona's newest mural, which pays tribute to the Kumeyaay Native Americans. The mural on the back of the Verizon building on Main Street is the 27th mural created by the nonprofit Ramona Heart Mural Project. Artist Simon Melnick created the mural with a goal to, quote, celebrate Kumeyaay culture in its untouched state by venturing into their world before European contact. He constructed the painting out of 26 individual panels, which he then assembled to form the completed 1,200-square-foot mural. As with all Ramona mural projects, viewers are challenged to discover the heart icons hidden in the mural. Each mural reflects aspects of the community's heritage. In the acronym HEART in Heart Murals, the H stands for History and Hiking, E for Equine, A for Arts, Antiques, and Agriculture, R for Rural Scenes, and T for Tasting of Wines, all things for which the Ramona region is known. For information on where to view murals in Ramona, or to support the nonprofit Ramona Heart Mural Project, you can visit ramonamurals.com. Reporting for East County Magazine, this is Elijah McKee.
A free press is the foundation of our democracy. You can support independent public media for our region by making a donation or a sustaining monthly pledge of any amount at www.knsj.org. We're your community radio station, KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, serving the San Diego border region from the mountains to the sea. That's www.knsj.org.
Welcome to 2021 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
Our only prayer is to live as a creator intended on the lands gifted to our ancestors when time began, and to be able to manage and steward our land and resources in ways that are consistent with our values.
Today is Indigenous Peoples Day, and President of the National Congress of American Indians, Fawn Sharp, says the country is ready for a conversation about the centuries of injustice faced by Native Americans. The White House issued the first ever presidential proclamation of the Indigenous Peoples Day, shifting focus away from the federal holiday celebrating Christopher Columbus. President Joe Biden called for reflection on the violence and harm caused by Columbus and other explorers of the time. The first Native American cabinet member, Interior Secretary Deb Haaland, is hailing the restoration of the boundaries and protections for three national monuments, including Bears Ears in Utah.
It's not just about national monuments. It's about this administration centering the voices of Indigenous people and affirming the shared stewardship of this landscape with tribal nations.
The Trump administration scaled back the size of the monuments, arguing the amount of land under federal control was government overreach. A coalition of hundreds of Indigenous and social justice organizations are kicking off 5 days of fossil fuel protests at the White House. The groups will highlight the fight against the Line 3 pipeline in Minnesota and Gulf Coast oil and gas export facilities. Both the president and his predecessor rallied their bases this weekend. Biden warned a virtual meeting of the Democratic National Committee that political infighting could cost seats in next year's midterms.
We want 2020 as a unified party, and we're looking to 2022 as we do that. We need to stay unified.
At a rally in Iowa Saturday, Donald Trump accused Biden and congressional Democrats of pushing the country to the brink of ruin.
All Americans of common sense, Republican, Democrat, and Independent, must stand firm and you have to really stand strong and firm against Biden, crazy Nancy Pelosi, she's a nut job, and the extreme power grab.
As Democrats struggle to compromise on many key administration priorities, including the Build Back Better agenda, the president called for unity.
Just the Republican Party today offers nothing but fear, lies, and broken promises. We have to keep cutting through the Republican fog that government is the problem and show that we, the people, are always the solution.
Divides also persist within the GOP ranks, with some blaming Trump for the loss of the majority in the Senate. But Trump continues to push back, blasting those who fail to support his claims of election fraud.
Mitch McConnell didn't have the courage to challenge the election. He's only a leader because he raises a lot of money and he gives it to senators. That's the only thing he's got. That's his only form of leadership.
While there's been no announcement, Trump has hinted at a possible 2024 White House run. I'm Mary Sherman for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our A-Trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy online at publicnewsservice.org.
Courage is the theme of the 19th Annual Women in Leadership Luncheon hosted by the East County Chamber of Commerce on October 22nd at Viejas Casino and Resort. The keynote speaker will be Holocaust survivor Rose Schindler, who survived the Auschwitz concentration camp, where she was sent with her family when she was just 14 years old, and many of them did not survive. She is involved in the Butterfly Project, which has a mission to educate students about the Holocaust, and she is president of the New Life Club, a San Diego Association of Holocaust Survivors, most now in their 90s. She has previously been awarded many honors for her work and continues to speak at local schools and events across our region. Tickets to the Women in Leadership Luncheon, which also includes awards presented to other women leaders locally, are available at the East County Chamber's website. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
This is Brian Schrader, reporting for East County Magazine. Last month, Governor Gavin Newsom signed two new housing bills into law. The main bill, titled SB 9, and its companion bill, SB 10, are the work of California Senator and San Diego native Tony Adkins. Together, the two bills represent the most sizable shift in California land use policy in recent decades. The first bill, SB 9, focuses exclusively on reforming single-family zoning. There are approximately 7.5 million single-family lots in California, and SB 9 gives homeowners two new options when it comes to building additional homes on their lot. The first provision allows homeowners to build an additional home on their property, a total of two homes per lot. The second provision allows homeowners to split their lot in two. Combined, these provisions allow for the construction of up to three additional units on a typical single-family lot when one home is already present. New units could either be attached to the main unit to form a duplex or be a detached granny flat. SB 9 also standardizes the rules for constructing additional units and introduces some measures to ensure that eligible lots are concentrated in urban areas and that homeowners control the process, not housing developers. The Turner Center for Housing Innovation at UC Berkeley estimates that approximately 10% of single-family lots in San Diego County are likely to undergo construction by their owners under the new law. Additional housing units are subject to new statewide regulations. While local regulations have allowed for the construction of granny flats, the most consequential provision of SB 9 could be lot splits. According to Stephen Dietz, a Los Angeles-based housing developer, lot splits enable new construction to be financed independent of the main house. He goes on to say that prior laws made building granny flats, or ADUs as they're called by legislators, often prohibitively expensive, and that independent financing could enable more ADU construction. As with every major change to California zoning law, the bill has so far been the target of praise by housing advocates and the cause for some concern among homeowners. Supporters say that the law helps generate additional housing for California's undersupplied housing market by allowing millions of Californians the option to build more housing in single-family neighborhoods. The bill's opponents argue that the law circumvents local control of zoning and could lead to overburdened residential infrastructure, a change in neighborhood culture, and a lack of parking. Provisions of the law exclude housing that is inside a historic district or homes that provide some types of affordable housing. Further provisions limit potential construction to lots within urban areas with at least 50,000 residents, along with other criteria. These criteria are together intended to ensure that new development under SB 9 is concentrated in areas where new housing is most needed. In a recent press release, the office of Senator Adkins stated that SB 9, quote, widens access to housing for California's working families and provides homeowners with more options to create intergenerational wealth. The other bill, SB 10, allows cities to streamline the process of converting single-family homes to developments with up to 10 units, if they are near transit. The bill would not apply to most of East County's backcountry. San Diego County's urbanized areas exclude any land east of Alpine, as well as areas with less than 50,000 residents, or less than 1,000 per square mile. These criteria ensure that new development is concentrated in urban areas, where new housing is most necessary. Together, the two bills mark the latest attempt by California legislators to address the state's housing crisis. Sandag estimates that the county needs over 170,000 new housing units by 2029 in order to meet demand, with about 16,000 of those units being built in East County. Among San Diego's congressional delegation, the votes on both bills were split mostly down party lines, with Democrats in favor and Republicans opposed, though State Senator Brian Jones voted yes on SB 10 and no on SB 9, and Brian Mainshine did not vote.
The East County Magazine Show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interest, not special interest. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org. Now stay tuned for part two of the East County Magazine radio show. We have a special treat for you today for Halloween, some local East County ghost stories. East County has many reportedly haunted places. There are many stories of ghost soldiers haunting the former Army barracks in Campo, the final home of the famed Buffalo Soldiers Cavalry Brigade. The old Julian Hotel's original proprietor from the 1800s reportedly haunts the establishment, startling guests in his former room who have claimed he's even tried to climb into bed with them. Out at the old Vallecito stagecoach station, the ghost of a bride who never made it to the altar and died along the trail reportedly roams the premises searching for her lost love, clad in the wedding gown in which she was buried. And out along Lakeside's Wildcat Canyon Road, if you see a woman beckoning to you to follow her off the road, don't go. Witnesses have claimed she turns toward her victims to reveal no face at all, a dark specter intent on luring motorists off an embankment to their deaths on a roadway where many people have died. But the most spirited area in our region is the Anza Borrego Desert, according to many detailed stories of ghosts that reportedly haunt those lonely trails, mountains, and washes in that harsh, forbidding terrain. Storyteller Cactus Jim has written, "Many travelers, prospectors, and adventurers have gone into the desert never to return or be seen again. Others have returned with gold nuggets and treasures so rare that we could only dream of being so lucky ourselves. Desert lore, stories, and quests for loot and gold have made men greedy. Gunfights, murders, and death from starvation have left many dead on the barren desert trails. Their ghosts still walk the mountain ridges, gullies, and deserted locations they once traveled or lived, spirits with unfinished business who cannot rest. Some guard buried treasures and lost mines, while others battle perpetually until death, forever replaying their last moments of life," Cactus Jim wrote. So here are a few of the most haunting tales in that region, adapted from Desert USA and the Paranormal Blogspot.
In the 1860s, when stagecoaches were the primary means of cross-country travel, a special stage set out from El Paso, headed for San Diego, with a box of coins. The stage that carried the coins had one driver and a guard. When the stage reached Yuma, Arizona, the guard fell ill and the driver continued on without him. That same stage was held up by robbers somewhere in the area where the route meanders into Carrizo Wash in East County's desert region, between the Fish and the Coyote Mountains. The driver was shot during the robbery and the thieves stashed the coins in the south slope of Fish Mountain. The coins remain there to this day, they say, because there were too many soldiers passing by on the trail for the bandits to retrieve their loot. It is said that after the robbery, the dead driver and the stage continued through Carrizo, and after that, the stage disappeared, never to be seen again, at least not in an earthly form.
But some witnesses say that the Phantom Stage still forges its way through the deep sand, pulled by a team of four mules on moonlit nights. The Phantom Stage is driven by a lone driver hunched over as if asleep. No passengers are seen on the stage when it passes through Carrizo Wash, hesitating only a moment, as if planning to stop where the Carrizo Station once stood, though it's now only a pile of mud. The Phantom Stage continues on past the old station until out of sight. In the morning, you may think twice about whether you actually saw the Phantom Stage until you find ruts carved from wagon wheels and fresh hoof prints left behind by the ghostly stage that travels on occasion as if to keep the trail alive.
Vallecito is known for its ghost. Its history contains many murders, deaths, robberies, and other wicked tales. One well-known story involves a double murder at Vallecito Station. It all started with a stage holdup in which $65,000 worth of loot was stolen by four men on horseback who robbed the eastbound stage before reaching Carrizo Wash en route to Vallecito Station. As the men fled the scene, the driver of the stage fired one shot, killing one of the four men. When he reached the thief he had shot, he found not one, but two dead bodies. The driver concluded that the leader of the band of thieves had shot one of his own men, so he would not have to divide up the loot. The bandit leader and one of the thief survived the robbery and buried their loot in nearby hills, then rode on to Vallecito Station for a drink and some food. But the two bandits began to argue while having a drink. The leader of the outlaws went outside to check on his horse, promising to continue the discussion when he returned. He did return, entering through the doorway, mounted on his big white horse, and he shot his companion. As the wounded bandit was dying, he drew his gun and fired back at the leader, killing him off the back of his brave white horse. The white stallion, spooked by the gunfire and death of his master, ran off into the hills. It is said that when someone is in the valley, around midnight, near where the bandits buried their loot, the ghost of a white horse will appear from nowhere, galloping through the sand and then disappearing without a trace.
If you find yourself out late in the desert night, somewhere between the Superstition Mountains and the 17 Palms, you may see the apparition of an 8-foot glowing skeleton. A prospector by the name of Charlie Arizona first saw the ghost about 4 miles southeast of Borrego. It was a dark night when Charlie set up for camp. Just as he was settling down for the night, something disturbed his burrows. Hearing their frightened braying, he went to investigate. A shadow loomed large. Suddenly, he saw a large human skeleton with a lantern light shining right through its ribs. The skeleton walked in a crazy fashion, as if looking for something or as if it were lost. Heart pounded, Charlie watched, transfixed as the skeleton disappeared over the ridge. About 2 years later, two prospectors camping in Superstition Mountains caught sight of the flickering light in the distance and wondered what it was, but it quickly disappeared. One of the prospectors thought it looked like a skeleton carrying a lantern, but they figured it was just the fire reflecting off a rock. The two prospectors didn't think much of the incident until a year later, when a traveler came into the Vallecito station with the tale of a skeleton he saw wandering in the desert carrying a light. It wasn't long before the news of the skeleton got around, and two adventurers went out into the desert to search for this legendary skeleton ghost. During their third night in the desert, they encountered the ghastly lit skeleton. One of the men shot at it with a gun, but the skeleton continued on, unfazed by the gunfire. The two men followed the skeleton for 3 miles as it wandered in a strange and intermittent gait, over ridges and through valleys, before they lost track of it. Many believe that the skeleton is the ghost of a prospector who discovered and worked the Phantom Mine, which has been lost for many years. The skeleton is no better off than the rest of us, for he continues to search for the lost Phantom Mine, wandering the dark desert nights looking for his final resting place.
Not far from the Phantom Mine lies another place where skeletons have been seen. During warm summer nights, when the moon is full, ghosts dance at Yaqui Well. The ghosts are said to be the spirits of three emigrants who were traveling from Yuma to California. In search of a shorter route through the desert, the emigrants arrived at Yaquiel, exhausted and near death from lack of food and water. One of the three travelers drank from the well as much water as he could hold. He died shortly thereafter. The other two men also drank from the well, but survived. While moving their dead companion's body, the other two noticed some rock specimens that fell out of his pocket. The two men were excited to discover the rocks contained gold, but they did not know where their friend had found the samples. Their excitement about the gold turned into greed and distrust. The two men began to struggle until one finally drowned the other in the muddy water of Yaquiel. An Indian watched these events unfold from a nearby hill. He tried to talk to the man who had survived, but the emigrant was still so excited as he told his story that he entered a state of frenzy and ran off into the desert yelling, "Gold! Gold!" It is only during the hot summer nights of the full moon that the three emigrants return to Yaquiel. One rises out of the muddy waters of the Yaquiel. One emerges from the brush nearby, and the third arrives in the cool breeze out of the wash. The ghosts join hands and circle Yaquiel in a dance. Soon after the twirling begins, they disappear, leaving only the good waters of the well and a slight chill in the air.
In the 1800s, many stories began circulating about a ship lying half buried in the sands of the Anza Borrego Desert, and some say its spectral sails unfurl at times on a ghostly voyage, its phantom crew seeking their way back home. After the Civil War, many migrants who passed through the desert on their way to California reported seeing a Spanish galleon with multiple masts and swore this was no mirage. Most claimed that it was loaded with a fortune's worth of exquisite pearls. Many expeditions sought to retrieve these riches, but so far, none have succeeded. As the story goes, in 1610, King Philip III of Spain ordered Alvarez de Cordone to search off Mexico's coast and bring back pearls. Cordone hired two other captains, Juan de Iturbe and Pedro de Rosales. He also hired 60 pearl divers and had three ships built. In 1612, they set sail to plunder Mexico's west coast of its precious oysters. The ship paused repeatedly in its travels so that pearl divers could jump off and return with oysters they discovered on the ocean floor. Later, they found a village where Native Americans had baskets of pearls just lying about. The Spaniards arranged a trade of their fancy European clothing for the pearls, but instead swindled the Native Americans by giving them only rags and dirty cloths. Outraged, the Indians attacked the ship as it was trying to set sail. Cordone was hit by an arrow, and his ship was forced to turn around, but he ordered the other two ships on in the search of more pearls, commanding them to look north in the Gulf of California. As they journeyed up the Gulf, Rosales' ship struck a reef in a terrible storm. Before it sank, the crew transferred the valuable cargo to Iturbe's vessel, which sailed up the Gulf and eventually up the Colorado River and into the Salton Sea, or Lake Cahuilla, as it may have been called long ago. Some stories claim that the ship sailed into the Salton Sea to find the legendary Straits of Anian, an all-water route from the Gulf of California to the Gulf of Mexico. It's been said that the Salton Sea and the Colorado River ran high, filled with water during a flood that swept the ship into the vast inland sea. Some say that an earthquake happened, closing off escape. The captain was horrified to find the outlet to the ocean blocked. Water in the lake was swiftly evaporating. Soon the ship was beached on the California desert, many miles from the sea. The crew grabbed what few supplies they could carry and abandoned ship, trudging westwards toward the water. As the story goes, the survivors were finally picked up. Other versions of the tale involve a pirate ship loaded down with almost a million doubloons. Another story states that the ship was from King Solomon's navy, carrying the 10 lost tribes of Israel to North America. Another variation on this story claims that the Cahuilla Indians, knowing the Spanish were coming to take their riches and harm them, ambushed the Spanish party that came ashore. Then the tribe mounted a full attack on the galleon and after a fierce battle annihilated the entire crew. The Cahuillas began looting the ship of food and exotic items, but they could not move nor break into the heavy large iron chests in the hold. Then a storm brewed up, dousing the galleon. The Native Americans were forced to desert the ship, which broke from its anchor, drifted off into the storm, and sunk into the inland sea, taking its precious cargo with it. By the time the lake dried up years later, the ship had been long buried under tons of dirt, sand, and silt. How true could these stories be? Lake Kaweah did exist in the 16th century and had a tribe of Native Americans living nearby. It is possible that a flood occurred connecting the Salton Sea to the Gulf of California. The area between the desert and the Gulf has the potential to be hit with massive flooding, as we know from Hurricane Kathleen in the 1970s, which sent a 10-foot-high wall of water across the desert floor. So yes, it is plausible a ship could have been carried in on the surge and stranded afterwards as water receded. The sheer number of stories told by both Native Americans and frontiersmen through the centuries suggests some truth to these lost ship tales. Expeditions in search of the lost treasure ship began in the 1800s, after travelers heard tales from Native Americans. Some claimed that the ship seen in the desert was haunted and could only be found at certain times of the year. In 1870, several Indians reported seeing the ship west of Dos Palmas. Later that year, the Los Angeles Star published a series of short stories about Charlie Klusker, who claimed to have located the ship and its broken masts. He was organizing expeditions to bring back the missing vessel, which he claimed was filled with crosses. It was reportedly 50 miles from Dos Palmas in a region of boiling mud springs. But there were no further updates, and Mr. Klusker appears to have simply disappeared, much like the elusive ship. In 1878, three German prospectors said they saw the ship around sundown, about 120 miles northwest of Yuma and 40 miles east of Indio. The sighting actually cost one of the prospectors their lives. The two survivors reported seeing an immense ship under full sail floating over the desert, sailing like a cloud into the sunset. The prospector who died went after it in the next morning, but never returned. A rescue party eventually found him dead from a lack of water, and strangely, he was completely nude. In 1905, a prospector named Butcherknife Ike claimed to have discovered a fossil ship buried in the sand dunes of Borrego Springs. And in 1915, a Yuma Indian arrived in one town paying for his merchandise with pearls. When questioned, he claimed to have spent the night in a strangely shaped wooden house that was partially covered by sand. The people he spoke to offered him several hundreds of dollars for the night if he would take them back there in the morning, but he vanished overnight with their money. In 1933, Antonio de Fierro Blanco wrote a book discussing the story of Tiburcio Mancerna, a young mule driver who claimed he came across the lost Spanish galleon way back in 1775. Back then, Tiburcio was a mule driver for explorer Juan Bautista de Anza, who was searching for a land route from Sonora to Alta California. The young mule driver said he went into the hold of the ship and actually saw a treasure trove of pearls, but was never able to relocate the evasive ship. Many treasure hunters have gone after the missing treasure of pearls, but none have brought back evidence of finding it. Perhaps because these are simply tall tales, or perhaps because the shifting sands of the desert at times reveal and at other times obscure the legendary lost ship. According to some storytellers, the ship itself, now bleached white and desiccated by the whipping sands, blown by the desert winds, has become a ghost. If you're out in the desert late some night, you may just see an eerie otherworldly glow and hear the singing of those long dead sailors, the skeleton of a ghost ship sailing into the sunset or adrift in the moonlight. Is the mysterious ship laden with the fortune and pearls still out there in the desert? Perhaps sailing spectrally over the sands? Perhaps one day when the sands blow the right way, we'll be lucky enough to find out.
Now we have one last hair-raising tale to tell, and this one is about the mysterious giant black cats reported to be prowling the wilds of East County. A reader tells us that sightings of huge black cats the size of mountain lions or bigger date back at least to the 1980s when witnesses described a black cougar near Highway 67 at the eastern end of Poway. Zoology experts claim there is no such thing as a black cougar or mountain lion, though they once said the same thing about black bobcats, until one was killed by a car and proof positive was found that these once legendary animals existed. Another possibility is a black leopard, an exotic pet that's escaped. But a more likely explanation for the many sightings here is that there are black jaguars in northern Mexico, big cats that when fully grown can be much larger than mountain lions. An adult male can weigh up to 350 pounds, though females can be about the size of mountain lions and cubs even smaller. Jaguars have golden eyes, squared heads, and very powerful jaws capable of taking down a full-sized crocodile in the wild. Officially, jaguars have been extinct in California for decades. But have they returned? Or perhaps they never really left. Yet another possibility is that jaguars have bred with mountain lions. That, too, is thought to be impossible, scientists say, but they once thought wolves could not breed with coyotes, until DNA testing proved that they did, and frequently. Many of the early sightings in San Diego County of large black wildcats have been made close to the border, some very near a gap in the border fence in Hukumba Hot Springs, where the terrain was too rugged to connect the fence up. Howard Cook, the former head of Hukumba's planning group, told me there have been regular sightings in recent years of a big black cat believed to be a jaguar, and also what appears to be a golden black spotted jaguar at Lake Hukumba. Such a pair could give birth to cubs that could be either black or spotted. He believes the big cats crossed over from Mexico, and the town librarian's son also saw what he described as a black panther crossing Old Highway 80 and Boulevard some years ago, though there's technically no such thing as a black panther either, a term used by ordinary folks to describe any of several big black cats. Gene Garrity told us that he and a friend, both farm boys, were out hunting above Loveland Reservoir south of Alpine back in 1994, when a huge black cat crossed the road in front of them. The tail was very fat and very long, he said. We got out of my Jeep, and we were looking at the paw prints in the mud. They were huge, with very huge claw marks. I estimate the cat was close to 200 pounds or more, he said. Assistant Border Patrol Chief Rosario Pete Vasquez told me, I saw one on Mount Laguna maybe 20 years ago. It was daytime, and there was snow on the ground, so you could definitely tell it was all black. That big cat weighed about 100 pounds, he estimated. One winter night in 2011, the Reader reported that a resident of Hapatool Valley south of Alpine, Warren Storm Thunder, claimed he saw a jaguarundi, a black cat from central Mexico that is a little smaller than a mountain lion. Sharon Cremosis, a rancher and a friend of mine, insists she saw a large black wildcat slightly smaller than a mountain lion while driving her golf cart on a ranch she owned in a remote area of Boulevard near the border. A neighbor of hers has also seen black wildcats, she told us, and she's also seen mountain lions and is confident in her description. Ariel Brook, one of our very own writers, who is also a teacher, saw a large black cat running across a roadway in Deerhorn Valley about a year ago. It looked like a black mountain lion and moved like a wild animal, she said, adding it had a long cat-like tail. In 2012, a resident of Aguanga near Warner Springs at the base of Cahuilla Mountain reported she heard her dogs going ballistic and walked outside to see a huge black cat perched on a boulder near her barn, which had a pig, a goat, and horses stabled inside. She said the cat was creeping up the rocks and had glistening circles of gray on its black fur. It was smaller than a mountain lion, and it sounds to us like a black jaguar cub, which can have spots faintly visible. On a blog post, she wrote that neighbors saw the same thing. And the Union Tribune published a report in December 2013 of a couple near Miramar Reservoir who claimed to see a large gray-black cat about 4.5 feet long that swiftly vanished into brush on a steep hill above the water. There have been many sightings locally, though none have been documented with photos, perhaps because these mysterious creatures move swiftly and are often spotted at night. Plus, frightened observers may be more concerned with not becoming dinner than with snapping a photo. We first reported on these mysterious black cat sightings back in 2014, and our readers deluged us with their tales. A reader in the Anza area, in the northeast part of our county, says there were several sightings in 2014 in her area as well. A Pine Valley reader said she was putting out food for a small feral cat in her gazebo one night when she was startled to see what looked like a panther with an unusually strong build, a big head and coal black fur that she believes was a jaguar. I sure froze in my tracks, she told us, adding that she slowly backed up to her door just as the cat dug in its claws into the carpeting on the gazebo she'd been standing on a moment earlier and pulled up the carpet off the cement. On September 1st, that's just last month, Forest Service volunteers Peter and Chris Ruth wrote to warn us that hikers saw a large animal resembling a big black cat in a tree near Cedar Creek Falls in the Julian area, a popular hiking destination. Soon after, two women volunteers hiking the trail to pick up trash heard growling noises three times and promptly exited the area. Were those black jaguars? Or possibly black bears? Another species thought to be extinct here that have since been documented to have returned, though still rare. In 2013, a Border Patrol camera caught proof positive on an infrared camera in Inkapa where a black bear ran across the road.
But the big black cat sighting at Cedar Creek Falls becomes more plausible given a second big black cat sighting reported on October 26, just days ago, to our news publication by Cameron Forbes, who says he and his son saw a giant black cat walking past a campground in broad daylight at Pines Anita in the Julian area, the size of a mountain lion or even bigger. These huge black predatory cats have also been seen in Spring Valley. Last year, a retired U.S. Navy chief, Manuel Domingsong, said he heard his chickens making noise and he went out to find a giant black cat inside the coop. It killed a chicken that night, and at 5 a.m. the next morning, he went out to check his coop and found the black cat back inside, and the rest of his chickens were dead. The large cat leaped over a fence right in front of him. 2 months later, a college professor, Dan Moody, told us that his mother, Dee Moody, a retired high school teacher, saw a jet black big cat weighing at least 70 pounds that sauntered across an open field beside her Spring Valley house in broad daylight. She described it as black and shiny, with a tail at least half as long as its body. And then on Christmas Day last year, a retired professor came across two dead coyotes at the end of her cul-de-sac on the eastern side of Dictionary Hill in Spring Valley. Their throats had been slashed, and the bodies were still warm. Only a very large predator, likely a huge cat, could have killed coyotes, which are themselves a predatory species. We do have coyotes across East County, and you may hear their mournful howls at night. But if you're walking out in the dark in East County, and you happen to catch a glimpse of a huge black shadowy cat, or hear the growl of a large animal, remember the sage advice of poet Ogden Nash, who wrote, "When called by a panther, don't anther."
We hope you've enjoyed these haunting tales from East County. We extend our special thanks to the participants in today's special presentation: Miriam Raftery, Leon Thompson, Devario Bell, Tasha Matthews, Liz Alper, and this is Ed Barena. From all of us at East County Magazine and KNSJ Radio, to all of you, our listeners, we wish you a chilling and thrilling Halloween. Happy haunting!
This is Miriam Raftery, producer of the East County Magazine radio show. If you would like to be the media, here's your opportunity. We're looking for some more talented volunteers for our East County Magazine radio show. So if you've got radio experience or just a great voice, or if you'd like to get experience writing scripts or special reports for the East County Magazine radio show on KNSJ, we'd like to hear from you. You can call us at 619-698-7617 or send an email to editor@eastcountymagazine.org. We're your community media, bringing you news from our region that reflects the public interest, not special interests.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso in the heart of San Diego's East County.
This concludes today's edition of the East County Magazine radio show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technician, Jonathan Getz, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Corey Clement, Giovanni Galicia and the Smashing Beats, Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road, A.K. Jewel, Brian Boyko, Royalty Free Music, Frank Nora, Kevin McLeod, Blues 3 Music, and Pond 5. If you would like to underwrite or sponsor the East County Magazine radio show or get involved as a volunteer on our public interest news show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org. We'll be back soon with another edition of the East County Magazine radio show. A free press is the foundation of our democracy. You can support independent public media for our region by making a donation or a sustaining monthly pledge of any amount at www.knsj.org. We're your community radio station, KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, serving the San Diego border region from the mountains to the sea. That's www.knsj.org.